Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members Teresa and Linda, are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. I'm Tim Kenalty.
And I'm Gene Thomas.
We're doing something really exciting today. We're starting something new. It's our retrospective. Now that we have this broad catalog of content with multiple segments on different topics, we're going to start a retrospective. We're going to put some of those segments that have like topics together in individual episodes.
So if you want to listen to a particular segment that's caught your attention, you don't have to shop around between different episodes. You'll find them clustered together for you so you can listen to three or four.
So today's episode is a compilation of segments on beekeeping.
Here's the second half of the Home of the Hive retrospective.
Welcome back to the Hum of the Hive, a recurring segment of Nature Calls that follows the honeybee through the four seasons. I'm your host, Linda Eidlett, a Master Gardener Volunteer with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties and a Cornell University Master Beekeeper. In the previous segment, we talked about how the first few weeks of a worker bee life were spent working inside the confines of the hive as house bees, taking on roles as they aged that moved them increasingly closer to the entrance. Today, we'll talk about the third and last phase as she takes flight as a field bee. An essential need of any living organism is to collect food and resources to ensure its survival, and of course, honeybees are no exception. Honeybees forage for four things: pollen, nectar, water, and resin. Pollen provides essential nutrients to feed the larva. Nectar provides carbohydrates in the form of simple sugars to feed the adults. Water is used to both dilute the thick, viscous honey so it can be more easily sucked through their straw-like proboscis and to also cool down the colony in the heat of summer. Think swamp cooler. And resin from certain conifers and other plants is used to make a substance called propolis, which has medicinal or antiseptic properties to help the colony stay healthy and is also used to seal cracks and foreign surfaces within the hive. Regardless of the resource needed, honeybees have developed a fascinating means of communication to recruit a strong field force of sister foragers. It starts with a few scout bees who've returned with news of what they found on their foray. And to convey that news, they simply dance. It's called the waggle dance. Let's take a look at how it's done. When a scout bee returns, she climbs the comb and at a suitable spot, stops and starts vigorously shaking her body from head to rear end, very much like a dog wagging its tail. This is called the waggle dance, and it's very effective at gaining attention. She waggles excitedly in a straight line for a certain distance, abruptly stops shaking to make a hard right turn to circle back to the point of origin of her dance. Then she repeats that waggle phase with the same vigor, direction, and distance as before, but this time on the second round, she turns a sharp left to circle back again to the point of origin. This first round completes a figure eight pattern, which she'll keep repeating over and over and over to recruit sister foragers. She might even stop a few seconds to extend her proboscis to give potential recruits a little taste from her honey crop of what she's collected, just to seal the deal. So what is this dance communicating, you might ask? Well, researchers have discovered three things. First, the vigor or excitement of her waggle indicates the quality of the nectar. The more excited the waggle, the higher quality she's trying to convey. Second, she's telling others which direction this bounty can be located. Keep in mind that honeycomb is built vertically, that is, it hangs north to south, whether in a hollow tree trunk or a beekeeper's hive box. If our dancer is waggling straight up towards the top of the comb, she's telling others that the source is straight ahead of their entrance. If our forager is waggling in the reverse direction or down towards the bottom of the comb, she's telling her sisters it's behind the hive. If the direction of the path she dances is to the right, she's telling recruits they need to fly to the right at the very same angle she's dancing to find the resource. Conversely, if the angle of her dance is to the left, they must travel to the left as well. And the final critical piece of information our waggle dancer is conveying is distance. The length of time that she waggle dances before turning either right or left to the point of origin tells the prospective recruits how far to fly. 1 second of waggle equals a kilometer in distance the nectar source is located. Often many foragers are doing the dance at the same time. Think of it as sort of a dance-off, with each dancer trying to recruit as much help as she can to gather the bounty of resources she's found. Each waggle dancer is communicating to her sister foragers the quality, the direction, and the distance of what she's found. And how do we know all this? Although this behavior has been observed in writing centuries ago, it wasn't until an Austrian ethologist named Karl von Frisch published his investigative work in 1927 on the meaning of the waggle dance that a theory was offered to decipher this behavior. But his theory that bees communicated by dance wasn't too well received at the time. However, with subsequent research in the decades to follow, his findings were not only accepted as valid, but he was also awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1973 for his original research. While all of this is quite amazing to us, it does come at a very high toll for the busy forager. Weather permitting, foragers can fly up to 5 miles in any direction in search of forager, which is quite a bit of distance. And in her short period as a forager, she only collects 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey. So she has to make thousands of trips back and forth, back and forth, and back and forth. If we were to scale this up to consider what it takes to produce that pound of honey that's in your pantry cupboard, 768 foragers would have to visit 2 million flowers and fly over 55,000 miles. The point is that all this constant activity simply wears her down. So look carefully the next time you see a honeybee alight on your flower. You just might see a hairless forager with tattered wing edges, a clear indication of the wear and tear her body is taking to provide for the needs of the colony. It could truly be said she works hard for the honey. And on that note, we're out of time. Please join me again for the next episode of The Hum of the Hive as we delve further into the fascinating world of the honeybee. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley.
Welcome back to The Hum of the Hive, a recurring segment of Nature Calls that follows the honeybee through the four seasons. I'm your host, Linda Eidlett, a Master Gardener Volunteer with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, and a Cornell University Master Beekeeper. An essential need of any living organism is to collect food and resources to ensure its survival. Another essential need is to reproduce itself. And honeybees have a fascinating way of doing just that, both on the individual bee level as well as on the colony as a whole level. In previous segments, we've explored how individually bees reproduce themselves, as queens, workers, and drones, to maintain the division of labor needed to keep the colony humming along. Today, though, we'll be looking at how the colony reproduces itself, that is, how the colony reproduces another colony needed to maintain the species we call Apis mellifera. When we think of a colony of honeybees, we're actually looking at what's called a superorganism, the term used to describe a society, be it an animal or insect, in this case honeybees, with a highly developed division of labor where individuals within that society can't survive by themselves for extended periods of time without perishing. Neither a queen nor the male drones are able to forage for food, and workers, the female population, can't successfully reproduce themselves. They all need each other to survive both individually and collectively as a whole, that is, as a colony, or superorganism that collects, stores, and circulates resources, regulates water, controls temperature, senses both the internal and external environment, and reproduces itself. And it's reproduction at the colony level that's incredibly fascinating and we'll be exploring in this segment. Since early spring, if the weather's good and available resources bountiful, the queen's been laying thousands of eggs each day, and foragers have been collecting food to support both hungry brood and adults alike. The colony has been rapidly expanding, which works out well as long as the space they inhabit allows for expansion. But what happens if all the available cells are becoming backfilled with food stores or brood, and the colony runs out of room for the queen to continue laying eggs? Well, this is the point in a colony's life cycle where it reproduces itself as another colony. And to do that, it simply swarms. Swarming is a reproductive process called fission, where a single entity literally separates into two new and distinct entities, similar to, say, an amoeba. But before a colony actually swarms, certain things must first be put in order to help ensure survival of both the portion of population taking off in flight and the population of bees being left behind. For instance, up to now, the queen has only flown a few brief days during her mating flights very early in her life. By now, she's weighed down with thousands of eggs stored in her abdomen and is quite ponderous. And so to ensure that she can fly again, the queen is herded and run around the comb to help her lose weight. To replace the mother queen who's leaving, nurse bees are feeding a dozen or so selected larvae royal jelly so that one will eventually emerge as the new queen in the weeks ahead. At the same time, foragers and house bees are hard at work provisioning stores of nectar and pollen for those who will be left behind. And when the time to swarm is imminent, foragers leaving the swarm will gorge on nectar, as that will be their only provisions for the journey ahead. When the time to swarm has finally come, about half of the colony, mostly foragers and the original queen, literally spill out of the hive entrance and take flight in a swirling cloud. Believe it or not, even with perhaps tens of thousands of airborne bees swirling about, this is when the honeybees are most unlikely to sting, as they no longer have a nest to defend. Within about 15 minutes, the airborne cloud gathers to land in a cluster on a temporary rest spot, usually a nearby branch, where they'll hang for anywhere from a few hours to a few days to decide where to go next. And how's that decided? Well, researchers have found that honeybees have developed a fascinating process of working together to come to a collective consensus of where their new home will be located. Depending on the size of the swarm, dozens to maybe several hundred of the most experienced foragers, called scout bees, take off in search of a suitable home. They're looking for a dry cavity, maybe 15 feet up off the ground, about 10 gallons or so in size, with an easily defendable entrance, maybe a couple square inches in diameter, with walls thick enough to help keep them warm over winter. For instance, the hollow of a tree, or maybe the walls of your home. When the scout bees return to the swarm cluster, they must communicate news of what they found. And our returning scout bees use a method of communication we've talked about before. They dance. Yes, they waggle dance. But this time they dance on the outside of the swarm cluster. The point of this waggle dance is to recruit sister foragers to the location the scout bee found. She reports direction and distance as before with the same figure eight pattern, but this time the number of circuits, the number of figure eights that she does, conveys the quality of what she's found. The more circuits or figure eights, the higher the quality. Researchers have found that scouts reporting on premium sites will dance 100 or more circuits. Scout bees who may have not found as an ideal location will make note of the direction and distance of the higher quality reports and then go fly off to check it out herself. She then reports back to the clustered swarm with her own dance. This happens over and over and over until eventually a favored location emerges, with the vast majority of dancers, a good 80% or so, communicating the same location. Thus, a consensus is reached and the swarm takes off in that direction to make its new home. If the colony can successfully survive over winter, the whole process of reproduction by swarming will start over when this new home has reached its full capacity. This whole process of communication and consensus decision-making is where the term hive mind originated and is eloquently described in Cornell Professor Tom Seeley's book, Honeybee Democracy, which is available at many branch libraries within the Mid-Hudson system. I'll also include a link in the show notes to his YouTube lecture on this topic. While we may be alarmed when we see a honeybee colony swarm, it's actually a naturally occurring process involving collective decision-making developed by a superorganism to ensure its survival over the millennia. And if you think about it, perhaps outgrowing a home means life is good, at least for this colony of honeybees. So please join me again for the next episode of The Hum of the Hive as we delve into the fascinating world of the honeybee. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley.
Welcome back to The Hum of the Hive, a recurring segment of Nature Calls that follows the honeybee through the four seasons. I'm your host, Linda Eidlett, a Master Gardener Volunteer with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties and a Cornell University Master Beekeeper. We all know that honeybees collect pollen and nectar as food sources for brood and adults alike. And in a prior segment of Hum of the Hive, we talked about water as a critically important substance that bees also collect. Today we'll explore a fourth substance that bees collect, and that's propolis. Propolis is essentially derived from small bits of sticky resin collected from buds and bark of certain deciduous trees and plants. Some exotic examples of plant resins you may have heard of include amber, balsam, copal, frankincense, and myrrh, a list that no doubt conjures up images of faraway places. But in our more temperate regions, we'd be focusing on resins secreted from trees here in the Northeast, such as cottonwood, birch, alder, poplar, and many of the conifers and coneberry trees. Resin is a thick, sticky liquid that's quite pliable when collected by the foraging honeybee, especially during the warmer parts of the day when the resin is more free-flowing. She'll gather resin in much the same way as pollen, moving the bits and globs along her forelegs, which are then compressed into a compact pellet that's deposited into her pollen basket. As she's collecting resin, she'll lift herself up in the air every so often to test if she can still fly with her load. Once she gathers what she can carry, she heads back to the hive and crawls to the site within the nest where the resin's needed. Just as with pollen, a resin forager can't remove the load of resin herself. She needs the help of a sister honeybee, called a cementing bee, who will pull the resin off her hind legs and either put it to immediate use or place the resin load in a storage location where she could use it later. If the resin is used right away, the cementing bee goes to work, smoothing it into place, adding more layers of resin as needed. Once the resin is placed within the hive, no matter what the location, we call the substance propolis. Typically, propolis is composed of about 50% resins, about a third waxes and fatty acids, and about 10% essential oils and aromatic compounds, including vanillin, which gives it an amazing, not-too-sweet vanilla-like odor. In the summer months, propolis is quite sticky with a consistency much like saltwater taffy. But as the season cools into winter, it becomes quite stiff and hard and can break into shards similar to peanut brittle. Its color varies depending on the plant source, ranging from a light tan to a dark brown, and often has a reddish hue. The word propolis comes from the Greek, meaning before or in front of the city, which is quite appropriate in the case of honeybees, as one of the primary locations propolis is deposited is at the entrance to the nest to shape and resize the opening to make it easier to defend against intruders. Honeybees also use the sticky resinous substance elsewhere in the nest cavity to seal cracks and crevices against drafts and water, especially in autumn as the colony is preparing for the coming winter. But perhaps more interesting, it turns out that propolis plays a critically important role in the well-being of the colony that goes well beyond just providing a convenient sealant for cracks and crevices, and it's tied to an inherent property of the resin itself. Resins are sticky substances plants secrete in response to injury, such as mechanical damage or attack by insects and pathogens. For instance, if a conifer tree is damaged or cut, it immediately secretes resin to seal and protect the injury. Just as resin plays a role in the immune defense system of plants, propolis also imparts these same powerful antimicrobial properties to help protect the colony from bacteria, viruses, mold spores, and other pathogens. In fact, propolis is among the most powerful antimicrobial substance found in nature. According to the U.S. National Institute of Health, quote, propolis and its extracts have numerous applications in treating various diseases due to its antiseptic, anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, antibacterial, antimycotic, antifungal, anti-ulcer, anti-cancer, and immunomodulatory properties. Honeybees are faced with a myriad of diseases and pathogens and can't produce antibodies like humans do. So they turn to nature for resources such as resin to provide antimicrobial compounds for them. By bringing this substance inside the nest to provide what researchers call a propolis envelope, honeybees enhance the social immunity of the entire colony, which frees up energy for the bees to perform more critical tasks such as nursing, tending to the queen, comb building, and gathering resources. The cooperative use of external agents to protect a colony from disease and predation is a form of social immunity. Social immunity is found throughout nature and is an important part of many species' survival strategies. So the next time you're adding new plants to your landscape, maybe considering including a conifer or two, such as juniper, pine, or spruce, to name a few. Or perhaps a resin-producing shrub or plant. The U.S. Forest Service has a list of 20-some flowering resinous plants that include willow, birch, alder, certain herbs, and sunflowers among the list. If you do, you can be sure the honeybees will make good use of them. And that concludes today's Hum of the Hive. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley.
Welcome back to the Hum of the Hive, a recurring segment of Nature Calls that follows the honeybee through the four seasons. I'm your host, Linda Eidlet, a Master Gardener Volunteer with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, and a Cornell University Master Beekeeper. Many of our listeners may be aware that here in the Northeast and many other parts of the country have been experiencing a severe shortage of rainfall the past few months. Everything is crispy and turned brown, including critical food resources needed for a colony of honeybees to thrive. In short, we've moved into what beekeepers call a dearth, defined as a shortage of nectar and pollen-producing flowers. And lack of sufficient food resources can have a profound effect on honeybee colonies, depending on how long a dearth lasts. While the Northeast typically goes through a seasonal dearth each year in the hot months of July and August, the severe lack of rain in early summer has magnified the effects this season. Signs of a dearth that you might see in your own garden would be a more than usual number of foragers flitting from blossom to blossom, but not stopping very long because the nectar's dried up. They're investigating every small opportunity, looking for every drop of nectar. Hummingbird feeders that were previously passed over are now attracting clusters of bees. You might also find small clusters of bees gathering at dripping faucets and leaks in hoses trying to collect water to take back to the colony for ventilation and to dilute their thick, viscous honey stores. If prior months have been productive forage-wise, a colony has enough stores of honey and pollen to feed adults and brood alike until resources become plentiful again. However, when stores get critically low, sacrifices have to be made, some of which may be especially harsh, but are absolutely necessary to ensure the survival of the colony. Perhaps the first to feel the repercussions are the drones, or the male honeybees. While drones play a critical role in reproduction, they really don't contribute to foraging, nursing, or any other useful task within the hive. So they are expendable in times of short food supplies, and simply are blocked by guard bees from returning inside the hive, the only place where they could be fed. They end up starving to death. But to the colony, it's fewer mouths to feed, and drones aren't needed this late in the season. Even if there wasn't a dearth, drones would be forced out in late fall anyway, not allowed to stay through winter, for pretty much the same reasons. But drones only make up about 10% of a colony's population, and probably even less this late in the season. While kicking out drones may help with metering out nectar stores, other measures must be taken to help support larvae who require protein to survive. The queen may cease laying eggs, which helps reduce the need for additional protein resources, but this still may not be enough to support the current population of larvae, so they look to another means. Since brood is primarily fed protein, they themselves are a source high in protein, and researchers have found that colonies will more often terminate brood rearing rather than produce malnourished larvae. So when pollen reserves are depleted, the colony collectively assesses whether some of the brood are expendable. Maybe you can see where I'm going here. By expendable, I mean used as a food source, that is, cannibalized. Drone brood would be the first to be cannibalized. But as the dearth persists, younger worker brood would also be cannibalized and fed to the older brood. If a dearth lasts too long, the colony's population can be significantly reduced and it won't survive winter. In times of dearth, another behavior escalates dramatically: robbing. Honeybees are quite adept at detecting the sweet smell of honey and are not shy in trying to steal some from neighboring colonies. And if the targeted colony is weak, robbing bees from a stronger colony can overwhelm guard bees and wipe out a colony's stores in a matter of hours. Defending bees will fight to stave off the invaders, but are often killed by the sheer numbers of robbing bees that descend for the trove of food. Yellow jackets, bald-faced hornets, and other insect predators will often descend as well. But not for the honey stores. Instead, they're looking for the protein-rich brood they can feed their own young. A colony that was robbed in this manner is doomed. There simply isn't enough time or population remaining to make up the 90 pounds or more of honey needed to get through our Northeast winters. Remember, a forager only collects 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey in her entire lifetime. It takes tens of thousands of bees several months or more to accomplish that feat, and that's in a good flow. It's important to note that lack of rain and extreme heat aren't the only conditions that could trigger a dearth. Just the opposite could have a similar effect as experienced a couple weeks after Hurricane Irene came through our area in August 2011. Irene dumped huge amounts of rain and was followed by almost 2 weeks of overcast, cool days with little sunshine and very little or no nectar or pollen. Hopefully this extended dearth period will break soon, and foragers will be able to make up for any losses from the fall nectar flow gathered from asters and goldenrod blossoms so that the colony builds up stores to make it through to next spring. And it's not just honeybees that must survive these periods of dearth. Native bees, butterflies, moths, and other pollinators and beneficial insects are affected as well. It remains to be seen if extended dearths will become more prevalent with the changes in climate we're experiencing lately. You can help mitigate the effects by planting drought-tolerant native plants, shrubs, and trees, especially late-flowering natives. We'll provide resources on our website to help you choose which would thrive best for your location. And so we've come to the end of today's Hum of the Hive. Thanks for listening.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Powers and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.